from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this morning's opening hour, President Obama and the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, are set to meet today. It's a day after Amnesty International released a report criticizing the extent of Pakistani civilian deaths from U.S. drone strikes. And the findings come as relations between the two countries are starting to warm after a major breakdown following the 2011 raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan. The White House has recently pledged over $1.5 billion in military and economic aid to Pakistan, and we'll discuss the meeting, its implications, and much more, all coming up next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. President Obama meets today with Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif at the White House, and the meeting takes place in the wake of a report from Amnesty International released just yesterday on the killing of civilians in Pakistan, which estimates the death of over 3,000 civilians since 2004. On Friday of this week, the matter of drones killing civilians in Pakistan will be taken up in the United Nations, and additionally, the United States has decided to unfreeze $1.6 billion in aid, military and civilian aid, to Pakistan, which has received no United States aid since 2011, the year the Navy SEAL raid went into Pakistan and killed Osama bin Laden. In this morning's opening Forum Hour, we want to turn our attention once again to ongoing challenges in the U.S.-Pakistan relations and find out what we might expect of this meeting between the President and the Prime Minister. First, we want to go to London and talk with Nick Childs, who is World Affairs Correspondent with the BBC. He's based in London and joins us from London this morning. Welcome, Nick Childs.
Hello, Michael.
Good to have you here. And I guess the place to begin would be finding out from you what we can expect between this meeting of the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Pakistan. I know that top on the agenda is economics, but what about things like drones, for example?
Well, I think it is an important relationship and an important meeting at an important time, Michael, because as I think the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has said, there is no more important relationship. But also, in the words of the title of a recent Hollywood film, it's complicated. So that's, I think, the backdrop to it all. But yes, Nawaz Sharif has come as the new prime minister, newly installed. As you suggest, the economy is important for him. That's what he made a lot of in his campaigning during the election, but also he said a lot about drones as well. In particular, he wants to stop drones. That's what he said publicly in the drone strikes. In the past, the Pakistani establishment, the Pakistani government, has publicly been critical of the drones issue and the drone strike campaign, but has been, privately, tacitly willing to accept it. The question is whether Nawaz Sharif is different or whether the many other important elements to the relationship that he sees with the Americans means that there will be some kind of, if you like, tacit acceptance that this will go on maybe at a lower level in the future. Because apart from anything else, the security relationship is broader at a time when it's going to be very important what happens in neighboring Afghanistan over the next year.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that with you, but you mentioned Secretary of State Kerry, who said there was a timetable to end the drone program in Pakistan, and the State Department refuted that. Now we seem to have, cross purposes. In fact, the negotiating, some are thinking, is not necessarily so much between Washington and Islamabad as between the CIA and the State Department.
Well, I think part of the problem and part of the criticism of the drone campaign from the outside looking in is not only the substantive issues of whether it's legal and ethical and what the actual real details are of who's been killed and what the damage in terms of potential civilian casualties has been, and that's what a lot of the campaign groups have been talking about. But it's also, if you like, the issue of secrecy, that it's been conducted behind closed doors, and part of that is the fact that the agencies that are involved, that this is a program, it's assumed that's largely been run by the CIA, so that's been an element of the secrecy, and to some people's view, the lack of accountability. But there are also the issues of where it sits, if you like, in what's become known as the Obama Doctrine going forward, of how to deal with the terrorism threat. And it seems to be very central to what the White House wants to do in the future in terms of dealing with this problem. But how you go about that, do you open it up a little bit more? Do you try to, in terms at least of the transparency, do you do more to reassure people in terms of how you go about it? And because of the political sensitivities around, maybe, for a time you might want to ease off, if you like, and it'll be interesting to see if there's any sort of public suggestion of that when Mr. Obama meets Nawaz Sharif. But the paradox of it is, as the American troop numbers draw down in Afghanistan, then potentially, as a tool, that could become more important to the United States in the longer term, the drone campaign.
Now we're talking with Nick Childs, who is World Affairs Correspondent for the BBC. He's based in London. President Obama, in a major policy speech back in May of 2013, promised increased transparency.
Yes, indeed. And I think that was, to some extent, an attempt to acknowledge that, you know, there is a cloud of controversy around all of this. And yet it does seem to be a central plank of how he sees dealing with the terrorism threat in the future, that it will be less of what's happened in Afghanistan, boots on the ground. It will be more of what some people say describe as sort of long and light, i.e. over the horizon sort of stuff, and perhaps with special forces, not just in Pakistan and the tribal areas of Pakistan connected with Afghanistan, but other places as well. And other groups and campaign groups beyond Amnesty International have been looking at for example, what's been going on in Yemen and in the Horn of Africa as well. So it's the sort of long-term and broader issues, I think, that made him want to say in that speech that he is, as the commander-in-chief, sees this as the rationale. And underpinning it all, though, he's insisting, despite the criticism, and he insists that from the Obama administration's perspective, it is with the parameters he says that they employ, it is a legal and just way of dealing with this very difficult issue.
And you mentioned Yemen. There was a Human Rights Watch report on that as well, and drone use in Yemen. But let me go with you just for a moment, Nick, to the ongoing concern about Afghanistan and the Taliban and the role that Pakistan plays in that, because certainly Pakistan intelligence services have been tied to terrorists in the past and in many people's minds may still be. And I guess it boils down to a question in many Americans' minds. What kind of bang are we going to get for our buck as far as putting $1.6 billion back into Pakistan?
Well, that's right, and I think there's no doubt that security is huge for both sides in all of this, but they come at it from a different perspective, and clearly, the United States sees Pakistan as having an important role to play, including in trying to get to reboot, if you like, some kind of political negotiation with the Afghan Taliban. But the problem is there is this. Friction, if you like, between how many in the Pakistani establishment see the security situation, the suspicions that they have of where an Afghan government will go in the future, while the Afghanistan government is saying you're not doing enough, Pakistan, to deal with, frankly, a safe haven of Afghan Taliban on your side of the border. So that's really been a tension that's been going on really from the start of the Afghan conflict, if you like. I remember when I was first covering the Pentagon in the early days of the Afghanistan conflict, when it was Al-Qaeda first and then the Taliban, and US military officials were talking about the hammer and anvil approach, that the Americans were providing the hammer of pushing the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban out of Afghanistan, and the Pakistan army were providing the anvil against which they would come up on the border. But that anvil has never materialized quite in the way that the Americans have wanted. So it's been trying to square that circle and try to produce security through what are frankly slightly different prisms as far as the perspectives from Islamabad and from Washington are concerned.
Nick Childs, again with us from London, World Affairs Correspondent for the BBC. Thank you so much for joining us, Nick.
Thank you.
Let me tell you who else is joining us for the hour. Daniel Markey is with us from the nation's capital. He's a senior fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia with the Council on Foreign Relations, author of No Exit from Pakistan, America's Tortured Relationship with Islamabad. And thanks for joining us, Daniel Markey. Good to have you aboard.
Happy to be with you.
Also, glad to have with us this morning Malaka Samdani, who is director of the Critical Connections nonprofit group in Massachusetts. They're committed to improving understanding of the Muslim world through analysis and outreach. He's also former advisor to the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project and adjunct fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and joins us this morning from Massachusetts. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. Let me, if I may, Daniel Markey, go to you on this and just follow up a little bit with what we were talking about with Nick Childs. Billions seem to be linked now, or 1.6 billion at least, to maybe a scorecard of security objectives with Pakistan. And the military is going to be presumably used to fight on the western border regions against Al-Qaeda. And in the past, we haven't really gotten that much for the kind of money we've put in. And there's been a lot of deception.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I think we should be careful, though. This latest announcement of military assistance, about $1.6 billion, is actually, as I understand it, the release of money that was in the pipeline for some time. It's money that the United States had committed to providing Pakistan for assisting Pakistan's counterterror and counterinsurgency efforts in recent years. It got turned off by the stepwise sort of rupture or near rupture in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship in 2011 and 2012, and now it's being turned back on. So it's really more, I think, of a sign of trying to get back to a kind of more of business as usual, or as it was before the bin Laden raid, before a variety of other things made the relationship go sour. And it doesn't necessarily lead us, or shouldn't lead us, to believe that Pakistan will come around in any radical or significant way to seeing the problem of insurgency along its border or inside of Afghanistan more in the way that we would want it to. But we shouldn't neglect the fact that, you know, now with 2014 looming, U.S. forces are going to be drawn largely out of Afghanistan. Pakistani roads and ports will be the way that much of the material gets pulled out. And bringing a degree of stability, a lasting stability, after most of NATO forces leave in Afghanistan will require some degree of Pakistani influence. So we're not going to get all we want, and $1.6 billion certainly won't get us there, but it may get us a narrow room for greater and better cooperation than we've had in the recent past.
Well, Malaka Samdani, the book title by Daniel Markey suggests, it makes me think of Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit, Hell is Other People. The lack of trust between these two nations, it's quite profound. And when you think about the nuclear arsenal and the growing military ties with China that Pakistan has, and all this tension over India and Kashmir, it seems like, sometimes, frankly, it seems just like a Gordian knot that we can't untie, or can't seem to untie. Are we warming up our relations, possibly? Does this look positive to you?
I think so, Mike. As Dan mentioned, over the past 2 years, relations between the two countries had really deteriorated and really sort of reached an all-time low in 2011, following the Raymond Davis affair, the bin Laden assassination, and then also the Salalah incident, in which 24 Pakistani soldiers were accidentally killed by U.S. troops from across the border. That was followed by a severance of sort of a blocking of supply routes to NATO. These were reopened last year in July, and since then, relations have begun to improve. And I feel that this meeting between Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and President Obama really is significant in that with the new civilian leadership in Pakistan, I think there is going to be a concerted effort to warm ties, improve ties with the U.S., because Nawaz Sharif, being a very business-friendly person and leader, is really going to try and jumpstart the economy, which has over the past couple of years really stagnated and has been growing at a rate of less than 3% per year. And so I think I think there has, I think this, him coming over here and meeting Kerry and then Obama is really trying to sort of get away, not just get away from the security issues and really try and focus on where there is, you know, mutual consensus, such as issues on economy and energy and trade and, you know, sort of trying to use those avenues to improve relations. I mean, as you know, I mean, even now, anti-U.S. sentiment in Pakistan is extremely high. I think there was a Pew poll done recently this year, and it was, I think, at about 74% of Pakistanis still have a very unfavorable view of the United States. But I will say that it's not completely irrational, this sort of, you know, approach to the U.S. that the Pakistani public has. You know, when there was the earthquake and the floods, following those natural calamities, when the U.S. did come in with a lot of humanitarian aid and a lot of help, we did see that somewhat reversed. Over the past 2 years, again, with the, you know, the incidents that I mentioned, you know, actual issues did lead to sort of a dip in relations again. So, I mean, it's not just in a vacuum that, you know, perceptions go up and down. Things happen, diplomatic failures take place, or incidents such as the one that happened in Salalah take place, and as a result of which, you do see a rise in anti-American sentiment.
Well, that anti-American sentiment has been borne out by the fact that drones have killed many civilians and have put many civilians under a great deal of psychological strain, to put it mildly. And there's been escalation of violence actually since Sharif took office. And yet, how do we get past, I guess, the big question in my mind, Daniel Markey, is not only this anti-American sentiment, but just the lack of trust between these two nations. I was reading, as perhaps you've read, Hussein Haqqani, Pakistan's former ambassador, who has talked about the fact that he says, I'm just reading, in fact, from this interview, the suspicion in Pakistan is that the U.S. wants to defang Pakistan's nuclear program. The U.S. cannot accept a Muslim country having a strong military, and America wants Pakistan to be subservient to India just as it wants Arabs to be subservient to Israel. And he goes on to say that there are those who believe that Americans are putting microchips in the brains of Pakistanis. In fact, even a high-up university vice president of the major university in Pakistan. This suggests, particularly with the ongoing concern about drones, that we've got a lot to really cover here. I mean, just in terms of building up trust.
Yeah, I think that's right. Look, there are different strands of anti-Americanism in Pakistan, some of them that you've alluded to in terms of a sense that the United States can't be trusted. These date back decades. This is not new to drones. We've seen during the late Cold War, the 1990s, Pakistan accused the United States of abandoning it in its time of need after the end of the earlier Afghan War with the Soviet Union. In the 60s and 70s, the United States was also accused of having abandoned Pakistan in its wars with India. So that narrative of lack of trust and a lack of U.S. commitment in Pakistan has deep roots, and the past decade has sort of reinforced that. And how to go forward is, I think, not to believe that the steps that the United States has tried to take in terms of assistance, whether military or civilian assistance, billions of dollars, are going to buy or win hearts and minds, so much as sort of the steady evidence of a partnership that seems to work for Pakistan. And the problem over the past decade is that the evidence of partnership has been, from a Pakistani point of view, very painful. It has been a violent period, and exceedingly, but tens of thousands of Pakistanis have died over the past decade, and the vast majority of those not from U.S. forces or drones or anything like that, but from violence and terrorism inside of Pakistan. And this is not the United States' fault per se, but it corresponds with the war in Afghanistan. And so the way to begin to get Pakistanis to see value in partnership with the United States, if not to love or have affection for the United States, may be to suggest that there are opportunities in terms of trade, regional economic integration, infrastructure programs, and the like, things the United States could begin to invest in more heavily. But it will take a very long time. And so when Nawaz Sharif comes here to Washington and he's looking to advance sort of narrow agendas on the economy and so on, from the American perspective, that seems beside the point. But from a longer-term perspective, I think that it's precisely the direction that both sides should be looking to go.
If I could go back, Malakas Mdani, to you on this, let's talk for a moment about the drones, because Mustafa Kadri, who is a Pakistani researcher who worked with Amnesty International, this report that was released just yesterday, talks about drones as licensed to kill beyond the reach of the courts or even basic standards of international law, and he says it's time to come clean and hold those responsible accountable. No redress for families. We have incidents such as a group of laborers being killed, a 14-year-old boy, a 68-year-old grandmother who was just gathering vegetables. And a lot of this is really going on in the northwest part of Pakistan to a great degree. I mean, something, I guess, has to give here, doesn't it, if we're to warm up and have better relations with Pakistan?
Absolutely. And it's just precisely this lack of accountability and impunity with which the U.S. tends to operate in these regions that really increases anti-American sentiment, I believe. Even now, about 68% of Pakistanis have a very unfavorable view of the drone strikes. And, you know, the Amnesty International report was excellent in its detail and really sort of digging in deep into nine separate cases of where drone strikes killed civilians. But even last year, Mike, there was a very comprehensive report by NYU and Stanford where they came up with how people within the Fatah regions, within the tribal regions, have absolutely altered their patterns of behavior because of a threat of constant drone strikes. And these are because, I mean, I'm sure you know that there are two kinds of strikes. There's a personality strike where the quote-unquote known bad guy is targeted. And then there is a signature strike where people and groups are targeted based on their behavior. And so now people in the tribal regions have literally, you know, stopped going to communal gatherings, have changed the way they conduct funeral rites, have, stay away from large-scale marriages or marriage, you know, wedding ceremonies and stuff because of the threat, because they might be targeted based on that behavior. And I think Amnesty sort of highlights that fact by the case of the 18 laborers that were killed.
Excuse me, they also highlighted a case in which rescuers came and they were targeted as a result of there being in a fairly considerable number of people. They became targeted and were even unable to rescue civilians who had been unfairly targeted.
Absolutely. In fact, last year, I think it was the UN Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism that accused the Obama administration of carrying out alleged double-tap strikes. And these are, again, like you said, rescue missions, people who go in after a strike to rescue the victims and then are targeted in return. And so, I mean, these are things that really tend to sort of, you know, again, that the secrecy surrounding them, no sort of redress to the victims' families, they have nowhere to go. That is the kind of thing that fuels anti-American sentiment. But again, going back to Dan Markey's remark, and I completely agree with him, that it is, in fact, civilian assistance that is actually going to improve this relationship between the public and the American administration, between the Pakistani public and the, you know, you know how bad the energy shortages are right now. And over the past year, the American administration has given $280 million to boost the energy sector in Pakistan. Before that, it had given significant amounts to improve the power grid. I think if those things are highlighted, I think the Americans have done quite a lot in that regard. But I think there's a certain lack of...
Let's hold that thought, Malaki, because we're coming up on a break, and it's a hard break, and I have to go to it. And I also want to invite our listeners to join us. Are you hopeful about the meeting today between President Obama and Prime Minister Sharif, a turn perhaps for the better in U.S.-Pakistan relations? And what about drones? Join us. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls. So join us now at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. President Obama is meeting Pakistan's Prime Minister Sharif today amid a great deal of criticism about U.S. drone strikes that came from Amnesty International. And Jay Carney, spokesman for the White House, says we are strengthening U.S.-Pakistan relations. And what do you think about that? I mean, do you think that is in the cards here? And to what extent do we need to do something about drones being sent into Pakistan, particularly up in the northwestern region of Pakistan? Amnesty International, of course, is very critical of that. We're going to hear some more about that. But in the meantime, the economic ties that are trying to be forged are quite serious. And Malaka Samandani was telling us before we went to that break about, and she's again director of Critical Connections, about things in the energy level. What else on the positive side of economics?
Also, trade, Mike. You know, there's again, being a business-friendly leader, you know, Nawaz Sharif has really tried to sort of place a lot of emphasis on increasing bilateral trade. Over the past couple of years, I think it's sort of stagnated at the $5.7 billion level. And, you know, Sardar Aziz, the advisor to Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, has suggested that they're really looking to double that over the next 5 years. And again, you know, while they're in the, if you watch the Pakistani press and watch the Pakistani media, you'll think that drones is the only thing on the agenda. But the Foreign Office in Pakistan has been at great pains to sort of assure the Pakistani people, while they shouldn't have great expectations, you know, economic ties and the energy sector reforms, privatization, trying to get investment in Pakistan from U.S. companies is what this trip is really about.
And Malaka, so I think this. I'm sorry. I thought you would pause. I just want to reintroduce you. Malaka Samandani is with us from Massachusetts, and she's director of Critical Connections. They're a nonprofit in Massachusetts committed to improving understanding of the Muslim world through analysis and outreach. We also have Daniel Markey with us, senior fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia with the Council on Foreign Relations, author of No Exit from Pakistan, America's Tortured Relationship with Islamabad. And I ought to mention the fact that, as Daniel Markey said earlier, this 1.5 or 1.6 billion actually has been unfrozen, but we've gone from 30% economic aid to 41% economic aid, so that has been jacked up a bit. I wanted to go to your calls here in just a moment, and I will, as well as your emails. And again, you can join us toll free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's at KQED Forum. But first, I want to go to Stanford and James Cavallaro, who directs the Stanford International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic and is director of Stanford Human Rights Center. And Stanford did a good deal of research on drones, and we don't want to necessarily drone on here about drones, James Cavallaro, but it is serious, and there are a lot of civilians that are being hit and have been hit. And at this point, Amnesty International report simply highlights that to a greater degree.
Yeah, absolutely, and thanks for having me. It's good to be on the program. I think there are several issues, and some of them your guests, Malaka and others, have addressed, and the Amnesty report highlights this. First is the level of civilian casualties, which is quite significant. And what makes that particularly significant in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, I would say, is that for many years the United States denied the existence of drone strikes by U.S. forces in Pakistan. And
forgive me, not only the United States, but Musharraf and Pakistan leaders denied it. Yeah.
Absolutely. And also denied the existence of any civilian casualties. Last year, we issued a report which documented several incidents in great detail, one with over 40 tribal leaders that were killed. We went through the numbers and demonstrated that many, many civilians are killed. As Malaka has noted, civilians live in a state of constant fear. They don't know, with the drones hovering overhead, when the next strike will occur, where it will occur. It changes their life patterns. All of this creates an atmosphere in which there is great animosity and distrust towards the United States, and a good deal of that deservedly so. Among the things that we found as well, when you look at the issues, and I understand you're looking at the broader context, when you look at the fact that the United States denied the existence of the drone program, that Nawaz Sharif is here in the United States and he has called on the United States to end drone strikes. He is one of many civilian leaders who have called on this. One of the consequences is the effect of undermining Pakistani democracy, in that what happens is the civilian leaders, the elected leaders, come across as impotent vis-a-vis the ISI and the military leaders, who are suspected of having cut secret deals with U.S. military to allow drone strikes to continue.
I think that's a given, isn't it? I mean, there seems to be complicity in these the Pakistani military in these drone strikes, and the Air Force, for example, doesn't shoot down drones or hasn't shot down any that I know of.
Right. Well, again, it's a matter of speculation. I prefer not to speculate on what those agreements are. What I can say is that given the extreme distaste by Pakistani public sectors for drones, opposition to drones, 74% of Pakistanis view the United States as an enemy. In that context, the fact that civilian authorities pound their chests and say, we have to stop drones, drones are unacceptable, and they continue, serves to undermine Pakistani democracy. So there may conceivably, and by the way, I doubt this, be some short-term military advantage, and I question that for a number of reasons, which I'm happy to get into. But looking at the mid- and long-term strategic value and blowback effect of drones should cause us significant pause when we think about whether drone strikes moving forward make sense, even for U.S. security interests. But again, another issue that I think really needs to be flagged in terms of who's being killed by drone strikes. We know civilians are being killed. Amnesty highlights a 68-year-old grandmother, 14-year-old boy, and many, many others. But what's really interesting, I think, to point out is even among those who may be characterized as quote-unquote militants, a very fuzzy title that under international law is not the relevant standard. It's not enough for someone to be a militant for him or her to be killed.
Well, there have been some leaders, some Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders killed by drones, but they become harder to get. They become more invisible as time goes on.
But the statistics that we have, and I'll cite Peter Bergen from CNN and Reuters and others, indicate that the level of high-value targets is on the order of 2% of those killed, which means that the vast majority are probably dying in signature strikes, which Malekha explained are ones in which drone operators are looking at video feeds and deciding based on that a group of men are engaged in some sort of suspect activity. We don't know the parameters of these programs. We don't know the details of the decisions on these strikes, but we know the consequences. And that's probably where most people are being killed by drone strikes in northwest Pakistan in the signature as opposed to the personality strikes, which target a particular known individual.
James Cavallaro, again, is director of Stanford's International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic, which did a great deal of research on the subject of drones. He also directs the Stanford Human Rights Center. And thank you so much for joining us. Good to have had you on Forum.
Thank you so much.
And we'll have our callers on now. We go first to Bob. Bob, you're on. Good morning.
We're in a war, and these are non-standard combatants. And these are the kinds of people that they're using to wage war in Afghanistan. I mean, if they have 1,000 bombings in Afghanistan from the tribal regions focused on civilians, and we kill one out of our 1,000 that accidentally kills civilians, do we sit there and say, well, one out of 1,000 that we throw up our hands? You can just wreak havoc on Afghanistan. And another thing is, isn't it true? I mean, the problem here is the lack of economic activity in Pakistan, the lack of opportunities for people that could go either way, that really grab onto religion, grab onto nationalism, and go anti-American, where not only economic activity would increase our would give people something to do, and it would make lives go in different directions, which is really what I think this meeting is really all about.
All right, Bob, I thank you. Daniel Markey, get a response from Bob's call from you?
Yeah, I think he makes an interesting and useful point here. There's an almost impossible problem that we face along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border in terms of targeting the international terrorists that I think everybody agrees are based there, have been based there, and how to do that in a way that is least disruptive and most likely to serve the interests of U.S. national security without undermining a longer-term agenda. And drones have not been used maybe as effectively as they might, but they're probably more effective. I think you can make a reasonable argument that they're more effective than some of the other relevant alternatives. I don't think that the White House would have been content, certainly if we go back to 2007, where there was a national intelligence estimate that the numbers and scale of the threat of international terrorism based in the tribal areas in Pakistan had really gone up in the years after 9/11. The White House wouldn't have been content to sit back or leave that threat to something to address once it got outside of Pakistan. And at the same time, the Pakistani military has shown that it is either unwilling or incapable of going after all of these groups on its own, imposing the writ of the Pakistani state. And where it has, I think we should recognize that it's, you know, when the Pakistani military has gone in, it's caused massive population dislocations. I mean, millions, literally millions of people have been forced out of their homes by Pakistani military operations. The number of civilian casualties is never released in any comprehensive way, but significantly more than the drone strike. So this is a set of very bad options. And I would agree with the points that have been made before that the problems of drones are being exacerbated now and are more apparent than they ever have been before. And that requires a rethink and a recalibration of our counterterrorism cooperation with Pakistan. But we shouldn't expect that there's some easy or magic bullet solution that hasn't been tried so far.
Let me bring more of our callers in. Anita joins us next. Anita, welcome. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. So the question was, we're giving $1.6 billion, and do we know how much of that is going to go into funding anti-terrorism? And do we know, or why do we think that they're not going to be used for funding terrorism? Thanks.
Well, Malaka Samdani.
Well, I think the $1.6 billion that has been unfrozen now really was will go towards the coalition support fund category, where you know the Pakistani state has used those has used its weapons and its treasury to fight terrorism and terrorists in the tribal areas, and so this is a way to reimburse them. So again, there is no way of knowing exactly where that money will go, and that is for the U.S. agencies to determine how they're going to monitor those funds and where they go. I'd just like to go back to the previous caller's point and also what Dan Markey said in response. I think the reason drone strikes and military operations conducted by the Pakistani government are both not very useful because they really tend to ignore the underlying socio-political causes of militancy in Pakistan and in Pakistan's tribal areas. And so I think what the caller said was absolutely right. It's the lack of economic opportunity, the corrupt political, bureaucratic, and tribal structures in the tribal areas that have really allowed these militant groups to entrench themselves and have been, you know, received a lot of sort of support from the population itself. Those are the things that really need to be addressed in the long term and also in the short term to be able to, you know, address militancy. And I think that is an option that really has not been advanced fully, and that's what we need to pursue.
I want to bring in more of our calls. We'll get to as many of you as we can. Prafulla joins us from Cupertino. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. So, quick question to Malaka. What kind of security is Mr. Sharif ready to give us as to securing the investments that NATO and its allies has been making for a period of time for almost a decade now in the area? Because after 2014, when the troops are going to take off, what kind of securities are they going to be? And why should anybody expect Washington to release more funds if the basic securities are not in place?
Well, we're probably going to speculate to some degree, but Daniel Markey, some thoughts from you?
Well, I'm not sure I quite understood the nature of the question. I mean, the question is, why should we expect Pakistan to be more helpful post 2014? Is that?
I think that's the essence of the question. Yeah,
and I think the answer is we really don't know. And part of the problem here is a deep uncertainty about what's unfolding in Afghanistan itself. So next door to Pakistan, you've got a lot of outstanding questions, beginning with national presidential elections upcoming, which say something about the quality and character of the next national government in Afghanistan, and that's very much up in the air. And then you've got a set of negotiations with Afghan Taliban leaders that seem not to have progressed very far. And so the question is whether some sort of a political settlement with the insurgent groups is possible. And then from Washington's side, you have a great deal of uncertainty about what we're leaving in place, military and otherwise, in Afghanistan. And so Pakistanis look at all of that uncertainty. It's not surprising that they, too, hedge their bets. And so I think that Nawaz Sharif and President Obama will be having some of these conversations, but they're still, even this late in the game, probably going to sound fairly preliminary, both sides feeling each other out. What is it that you intend to do? What is it that we intend to do? Where are we on compromising? Where can Pakistan help narrowly on these various points that the United States wants to see and vice versa? It's the beginning of a conversation. I understand that the next round, the next major round at the ministerial level, will take place early in 2014 here in Washington, when Secretary Kerry will host Pakistani delegation again. But it's a very much a work in progress.
Let me thank Prafulla for the call. I'm going to go to some of your comments. Here's a Facebook comment that, frankly, I don't know what to make of it. This is someone named Ken who says, drone strikes are another example of the continuing trouble with NSA, illegal spying all over the world and providing bad data target. NSA, CIA drone strikes kill women and children, then double tap strikes kill first responders, all of which agree. But then he goes on to say, news media like KQED, NPR, BBC provide propaganda platforms to tell listeners the Pakistanis like getting bombed. I don't know when you've ever heard that on this or any other air, but he goes on to say, in spite of civilians like Malala Yousafzai, who say drone strikes create more terrorists than they kill, U.S. news organizations have not told the truth for 10 years. You, KQED, repeat Orwellian doublespeak that every strike is targeted, that everyone killed was a terrorist. Never, in my experience as a news correspondent, as a news anchor, have I heard that on this air or any other air? But I think the sentiments are pretty strong here where drones are concerned, and I understand that. Let me read some more comments. This is actually pro-drone. Devi writes, I'm not very hopeful until Pakistan severs its ties with Afghan Taliban. Terrorists targeting the U.S. continue to train in Pakistan. Why should we stop targeting them with drones? And James says, can you imagine the reaction if Pakistan was flying drones and killing grandmothers in the United States? And Dina says, I know our relationship with Israel is sacrosanct, but doesn't the current situation in the Middle East require us to rethink it? Aren't all our partners worthy of the same consideration? I think it has not served the U.S. well to put Israel's security at the top of the priority list to the exclusion of the rest of the Middle East. We have protected a country whose religion fits into our worldview best, but the world is different, and we must take that into consideration. Another listener writes, Mohammed Zubair said the U.S. drone strikes are the only thing that is helping the area, and that when there is a drone strike, people go about their daily lives, but if there is a strike from the Pakistan military, people go into shelters because of indiscriminate bombings and killings. Did Amnesty include this in their report as well, or are they only focused on the U.S.? By the way, the Amnesty report is on our website at kqed.org/forum, but it interesting question. If I could go to you on this, Malaka Samdani, the notion that the Pakistani military is, again, complicit in all this, and that the Pakistan military is not necessarily doing the job where its own people are concerned.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that, Mike. And it's not just the Pakistani military. It's also the Pakistani civilian government. Successive civilian governments have been complicit in all of this. We had WikiLeaks cable where the previous prime minister had said, you know, we're going to denounce drone strikes in public, but we privately endorsed them. And so they have been complicit with the military in allowing these to happen. And even though as much as I find drone strikes problematic and disturbing, I still have to say that the ultimate responsibility in sort of reining in these militants lie with the Pakistani government. And the Pakistani government has utterly failed to, over the past 12 or 13 years, develop a comprehensive anti-militancy strategy. In 2009, they had formed the National Counterterrorism Authority by European Union funding. And to date, that institution has not come up with a single policy document that would delineate what Pakistan's approach to its various militant groups are, whether it's the Pakistani Taliban, the Punjabi Taliban, the sectarian groups such as Lashkar-e-Changvi, Jaish-e-Mohammed, the anti-India groups, Lashkar-e-Taiba. There has been no effort to sort of delineate who's an insurgent, who a terrorist is, and to sort of, come up with a comprehensive strategy accordingly. And I think the fact that drone strikes are happening is ultimately the responsibility of the Pakistani government at many different levels.
And I want to bring more of our callers in. We go to Shivram. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I've heard a number of reports in various organizations, including, for example, 60 Minutes, New York Times, etc., where U.S. military leaders, generals, have testified that Pakistan has actively supported insurgents who kill U.S. troops in Afghanistan. If that is the case, why are we still sending them $1.6 billion of aid?
Well, I think that's an important question. And actually, let me go to the other side of that, too. It gets back to that whole question of trust, which is sort of a recurrent motif in this whole discussion of U.S.-Pakistan relations. I'm going to go back to you, Daniel Markey, but I'm also looking at an email here from a listener who says, what about the Raymond Davis case? How can people of Pakistan trust the U.S. government when such things occur? And that was a former U.S. soldier and CIA contractor who killed reportedly a couple of armed men in Pakistan, and he was released after the United States paid the victims' families $2.4 million. But again, there seems to be this huge, vast distrust between both countries.
That's right. This is a tortured relationship. And you mentioned at the outset that in my book, it's titled No Exit from Pakistan. And the intention is to liken it to the Jean-Paul Sartre play, where you have individuals in a living room who are there because they're actually in hell. And they're sent there to torture each other. And it turns out that they're almost uniquely qualified to bring that torture to bear. And the United States and Pakistan find themselves in a similar situation. They have tortured each other in various ways now for decades, and it's been especially acute over the past decade. But in the play, the door to this living room swings open at one point. It seems like the sinners can perhaps escape from their hell. They realize, in fact, that they can't. And that's the same case as the United States and Pakistan. The world is too small for the United States to escape from its tortured relationship with Pakistan. And as the correspondent pointed out at the beginning of the show, it's complicated as to why the United States continues to try to cooperate with a country that its own senior military officials, that is Admiral Mike Mullen, said in front of Congress that the Pakistanis have, in fact, in a way, have U.S. and NATO blood on their hands for having supported Afghan militant groups, the Haqqani Network in particular, that have killed American forces inside of Afghanistan. Why do we continue to try to seek cooperation? Because on some other narrow issues, like the Pakistani Taliban, we both see them as threatening. And because there's a hope that through that kind of cooperation, even narrowly conceived, eventually we can broaden out and begin to get more and more on the same page in our relationship.
But look at what happened in Abbottabad, though. I mean, it's hard to avoid thinking about that because the aid went into freezing. We violated their sovereignty. We went in and took out Osama bin Laden. From their perspective, that was a violation of sovereignty and unforgivable. But from our perspective, what was he doing there all that time and who was covering up and so forth? I mean, you know, it cuts both ways.
Absolutely. There's this deep well of distrust, and it's earned. It is earned certainly from the Pakistani side, and over decades they have been guilty of misrepresenting what they are up to and misrepresenting the terms of cooperation with the United States. This was true in the Cold War when we supported them as a Cold War ally, but Pakistan was essentially using U.S. dollars to build up its arsenal against India. And it's been true over the past decade. As we provided assistance to Pakistan, Pakistan has not tackled all of the groups and has been grossly negligent and, in some cases, much, much worse when it comes to dealing even with respect to al-Qaeda. But from the Pakistani perspective, they look at us, they see a fickle partner, and they see one that has come and gone to serve its own purposes, even as we, the United States, have claimed to be deeply committed to a partnership with Pakistan. So they don't trust us. They don't see that our claims of a long-term commitment to them or to their region are serious. And frankly, if you look at our commitment to Afghanistan over the past decade, you don't have to question too hard why they might come to that conclusion. We have been there, but we haven't sealed any sort of a victory in Afghanistan, despite long claims that we would. And we're leaving the place, it looks like, in a very difficult situation.
And we've historically,
next door to it.
Historically abandoned Afghanistan through the years, it ought to be added, I think. And I'm going to read a few emails here before I go to another call. Ben writes, the U.S. shouldn't give them a penny. The Pakistani government harbored the greatest terrorist of all, and any money we send will probably end up in the hands of the people who hate us the most. We should spend that money on more predators to slowly kill the terrorists that Pakistan does nothing about. War is messy, and those who we kill would not blink twice to kill millions of our innocence. Mike, on the other hand, writes, in the September Atlantic, there's an article that is essentially positive regarding drones. They say the pilots see the whole field, that they witness the terrible destruction, and they study the target for hours, weeks, months, etc. What is that not discussed when a grandmother tending her cows in a field is killed? Why is that? Let me bring some more callers on here, and we go to Salim. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I wanted to make a comment regarding U.S.'s policy of, influencing Pakistani socio-political, ecosystem there. There is a love and hate relationship between Pakistan and U.S. and public, even though it likes to love United States, but United States does not give it an opportunity to love. For example, I've seen in the last 20-30 years in Pakistan, it used to be a very peace-loving country, but Saudi Arabia funded madrasas in masses throughout the 80s and 90s, which ended up changing the behavior in Pakistani public to be more fundamentalist. Why can't U.S. for a change stop funding Pakistan for military aid and shift that funding towards helping to open up schools to change the behavior once again for the better?
You want to comment on that, Malaka Subdani?
Sure. I mean, I think, yes, the U.S. military and the U.S. civilian government, they've given a lot of aid to Pakistan over the past 12, 11 years or so. And, a lot of it has actually gone into economic development and schools and the health and system, and also to sort of invigorate the economy in general. I think the U.S. needs to do a better job of sort of marketing some of those projects. Again, that's a little bit of, it's difficult as well, because anything that has a U.S. name attached to it is immediately sort of delegitimized as well. But I think,
well, hasn't more money gone from Wahhabi sources to madrasas as opposed, when we're talking about schools in Pakistan?
Well, yes. In terms of, funding for madrasas, that's mostly the Gulf states have supported that. And a lot of that funding has actually come from the business community within Pakistan as well. Your middle-class traders who've, gone to Saudi Arabia and the UAE to get better jobs, and then have also then, sent funds back here. But as far as the public educational system in Pakistan is concerned, I think the U.S. has done a lot to sort of try and improve that as well, and I think they're going to continue to do that, as Nawaz Sharif recently stated.
I think we will have to leave it there, and we will certainly watch what happens between the president and the prime minister as the talks begin, and follow, of course, what is going on in Pakistan. Bill Clinton once said, "This is the most dangerous place in the world," and he may indeed be right with their nuclear arsenal. I want to thank all our guests and thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And when we come back for another hour, we're going to talk with Andrew Solomon. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.